All right.
Last week we had we finished up. We talked about we talked about scholasticism. Thomas Aquinas, a personal favorite of mine, so he got a lot of play in class here. See, that's the disadvantage or advantage. Guys that I like, that I think are important, I tell you about. Folks that I think, well, maybe not so, I skip over. So that may be good or bad about this class. Everybody's covered in the book, so I figure if I leave somebody out, if you're reading that history of the Christian church, you'll bump into them. But we talked about Aquinas. We talked about some precursor movements to the Reformation. We talked about John Huss, Peter Waldo, and John Wycliffe, and so I want to, you know, we're rapidly coming out of the Middle Ages, and we're going to hit the Reformation today, because that is probably the biggest sort of turning point in the history of the Christian Church. And so, you know, all this stuff is going on, coming out of the end of the medieval period. We're now in the 14th century, and the papacy, you know, in the West, the Christian church is still, the papacy is the focus. It's what runs the Christian church in the West. And it has had its ups and downs. There were some very good popes. There were some absolutely terrible popes. As with anything, it has its ups and downs. But there was a period of time in the 14th century where it kind of got real ugly for the papacy. And I think to some extent it was a real weakening of the papacy that allowed the kind of things that took place in the Reformation to take place. It's one of these things, you know, the big discussion in history is whether, you know, men make history or history makes men, you know, and when you look at things, you see all these little things that happen that not quite the butterfly effect, you know, the butterfly wiggles its wings in Brazil and it causes a storm in Africa or something, you know, there's that theory. But there's this idea that little things kind of in the line of history make changes. And what had happened is, you know, remember way back when I told you in 800, Leo III put Charlemagne on the throne. And Charlemagne was the great leader of the Franks, which was the beginning of the France, the rise of France, right? And a long time later, you know, 700 years later or so. And so the papacy had always had the support of the French, to some extent, and to the point that the Pope, for about 70 years, from about 1303, 1305 or so, didn't even live in Rome. Okay, the Pope moved out of Rome, and the Pope was actually up in Avignon, okay, which was a French town. And so you have a whole bunch of popes. Now, there was a lot of political stuff going back and forth between Rome and France, both trying to control the politics, and the papacy, to a large extent, was in the middle of a lot of this. And you had popes that France liked and popes that France didn't like, and popes that liked France and popes that didn't like France. And so, you know, this was going back and forth. But anyway, that basically the papacy had moved to France, for all intents and purposes. And that's strange to us, because we have always been used to the Pope being in Vatican City, in Rome. And it's strange that for this 70-year period, you've got the Pope living up in France. Not even, some of them never even came to Rome. And remember, the papacy had always been, during this period of time, the thing that Rome felt it that was their deal. The Roman citizens, you know, would put their stamp on who they should think should be Pope and whatnot. So this was a strange time. Well, finally, Gregory came back from Avignon, back to Rome, he comes back down, he sets up a shop in Rome, and everybody thinks, okay, this is good. Down in Rome, they think, okay, now we've got the papacy back, okay, from its exile up in France, Gregory the Ninth, and so he's in Rome, and he dies, and so now they've got to figure out, okay, what are we going to do to make sure that the papacy doesn't leave again? And this is a real popular man on the street kind of issue. This isn't just a theological thing. This is a political thing. This is a nationalistic thing. And so all the cardinals get together and they're going to elect the Pope to follow Gregory now. And they're concerned because if you elect a Pope that's popular with the French, he may leave Rome again. If you elect a Pope that's really popular with Italy and not so much with the French, then you're going to have to deal with the politics of France. And not, you know, nowadays politics is we send a diplomat. Back then they sent an army, you know. So what do they do? Well, this was compounded by the fact that the people in Rome wanted an Italian Pope. They wanted somebody from Rome, but they would take anybody from Italy. They didn't want a French Pope. And so mobs of people started to go to Rome to make sure that they got an Italian Pope. And so all the cardinals are starting to get worried. They're literally fearing for their life. Mobs of people would, during this time, would break into the Vatican, would riot in the streets. And so the cardinals get together and they elect a guy, Urban VI. Okay, so they elect Urban. And they think, this is a real good guy. He's a smart guy. He's really fair. He's easygoing. This will be the perfect guy. And he's Italian. He's not necessarily from Rome, but he's an Italian guy. So this is going to make everybody happy. And this way the cardinals aren't afraid that the mobs are going to drag him into the street and beat him up. Urban surprises them, though, because Urban turns into a tyrant. He was elected Pope on Easter Sunday. And from that point in time, this guy just went on a rampage against everybody. He was all over the bishops and the cardinals and the priests saying, you guys are terrible, you're corrupt, you have too much money, you need to be out back at your churches ministering to people, you're terrible, blah, blah, blah. And then he is against France. And so he starts immediately creating all these new bishops and cardinals that are all Italian because he's going to make sure nobody votes the Pope back to France again, right? And so basically Urban just angers everybody. The French, the pro-Italian, he just angers everybody. And he's just cleaning house. And it's funny because some of what he was doing might be, in hindsight, okay, some of that might have been okay. But even with that, the way he did it was terrible. And he got everybody upset. He lasted for about 4 months. And then all these cardinals, well, at first a small group of them, but then later on everybody that had elected him, they all headed out of town because they were worried about him attacking them. They were still worried about the people of Rome. And they went and sequestered themselves in a small town, and they took a vote, and they said, you know what? Urban's not Pope anymore. We are going to get rid of Urban, and we are going to elect a brand new Pope, okay, Clement VII. So they elect Clement, and they say, okay, Pope Urban is no longer Pope. Pope Clement is now the new Pope. Now, the interesting thing that they did was they said, we have to have justification for this, because after all, we're all the guys that just voted him in 4 months ago. And so they say, well, you know what? Really, we did it under duress. We were afraid all those rioters down in Rome were going to beat us up. And we were afraid for our lives. And so it really wasn't valid. And number two, this guy, because remember, they didn't like him at this point. This guy coerced us. It was his, he made us vote him Pope. And so we're justified by saying he can no longer be Pope, and this new guy, Clement, gets to be Pope. Okay. Urban doesn't like this. And Urban says, you know what? I know you're the cardinals that elected me Pope, but you guys are wrong. You can't de-elect me. I don't know if that's a technical word. I am still Pope. And your new guy that you elected, he's not Pope anymore. And so Urban starts making more bishops and cardinals that support him. And he hunkers down into Rome. Well, Clement, meantime, says, no, no, no. I'm Pope. I mean, the cardinals voted me Pope. I'm Pope. And so he heads up to France because he knows he'll be protected up there. He immediately puts together a small army and attacks Rome. And remember, we're talking, you know, 1370. So this is the 14th century. This isn't back in like 500 or 600 AD where you have marauding bands. You know, this is fairly civilized. We're at the end of the medieval period. We're at the beginning of the Renaissance here. this is crazy stuff. So now you've got two popes, and they both claim to be legitimate popes because they were both voted in by the exact same group of cardinals and bishops. It's hard for us nowadays to understand that, because nowadays there has always been a smooth succession in the papacy. And part of the reason why there is what we'll find came out of this period of time. The church wanted to make sure it didn't have this problem again. But what you've got is now the Christian church in the West has two guys claiming to be pope. They both claim complete authority. They both have their own cardinals and bishops who back them up. And they both have the political power. Everybody in Europe lined up behind one of these two popes. Those that were allies of France lined up behind Clement. Those who were allies of Italy, or enemies of France. Remember, France and England had been in the Hundred Year War. So England and France weren't getting along. So England lined up behind Urban. So it sort of splits all of Europe politically. And the people that suffer in all this was the Christian church. The Christians, because they, you know, if you're like a Joe average Christian back here in 1378, who do you follow? You know, you've got two guys who are claiming to be the head of the Christian church. Well, this goes on for a while. Ultimately, this will go along for probably about 40 years. And each one of these guys, as they would die, they would name their own successor. So for a long period of about 40 years, you've got two different men, one in France, one in Rome, who are claiming to be pope and who now have created a whole church around themselves. They've created all these bishops, all these cardinals, and they say, nope, we're really the true guy. They're claiming complete authority of the papacy. This gets to be just too hard to handle for everybody. Everybody just gets sick of this after about 40 years or so. And so these theologians and church leaders start to weigh in on this, and they say, okay, we have to do something. What are our options here? Well, the best option is if we can just get these guys to just resign, and we'll get a new pope. They have other options, but they think we need to do this. So what they do is they decide they're gonna have a general church council. Little town called Pisa in Italy. They're going to get everybody together, and they're going to work this out there in this church council. Well, both the popes at the time, the one in France and one in Italy, decide we're not going along with that. We're not going to have anything to do with this. So they don't support this. And the church council there in Pisa actually ends up making the matter worse, because they decide that neither one of these guys are pope. We're going to elect a brand new guy. Now you have three guys, all simultaneously claiming to be pope, all three who have their own set of cardinals and bishops who are supporting them. The guy that the council at Pisa elects, he lasts about 6 months and then he dies. He is now followed by a guy, John the 23rd. I should note that if you remember, if you're 40 years or older, you'll remember that there was a John the 23rd who was pope in the 60s, famous pope. He was the one who initiated Vatican II. He was a great guy. I mean, of all the modern popes, I really like this guy. He was a good guy, John the 23rd. He is not the same as this John the 23rd back in the 15th century. They're not related. The reason why he was able to take that name is interesting. A big problem that you have as a modern-day Catholic church historian is you have to figure out, because as a modern-day Catholic historian, you have to show how the current Pope Benedict goes back in line to St. Peter. And it's pretty good until you hit this time. And they say, well, I've got two, you know, for 40 years, two guys, and then I got three guys. Which one is the right pope? Well, they didn't agree with the John the 23rd guy. Modern-day Catholic historians will tell you that the pope that came out of the Council of Pisa wasn't a true pope. So because he wasn't recognized as a true pope, that let John the 23rd, the modern pope, take that name. Okay, so that's some people get confused when you get to this point in time, because you have two guys with the same title. John the 23rd back in the 14th century was an interesting guy. 15th century, he was a real egotist, and he was very happy to be pope. And he said, no, I am now the true pope. It's not that guy in France. It's not the pope in Rome that followed Urban. I'm the new guy. the problem was you still had three guys all claiming to be Pope. And this is, the church at this point is just absolutely done with this. So they call another council. And this council says, okay, once and for all, we have to get rid of this problem. And what they did was fascinating. And this set the seed for nowadays, the modern view of the church and the papacy, okay? This particular council was called the Council of Constance in 1415, so it's 15th century. This council said, you know what? This council, being the group of all the church, is now the last word. And it has more power than any single person, including the Pope. That's how it set itself up. So I want to read from the document, Sacrosancta, the decree that came out of the Council of Constance here, where it states that it now has the ultimate authority. So this document says, "This Holy Council of Constance declares first that it is lawfully assembled in the Holy Spirit and that it constitutes a general council representing the whole Catholic Church, and that therefore it has the authority immediately from Christ, and that all men of every rank and condition, including the Pope himself, is bound to obey it in matters concerning the faith, the abolition of the schism," in other words, all these guys call them popes, "and the reformation of the Church of God in its head and in its members. Secondly, it declares that anyone of any rank and condition excuse me, who will refuse to obey the orders, decrees, statutes, or instructions made or to be made by this Holy Council or by any other lawful assembled General Council shall," and I like this, "unless he comes to his right frame of mind, be subject to penance and punishment that's fitting." So what happens is the church itself says, we don't want these three guys fighting it out anymore. We need to establish rule again within the Christian church. Well, John the 23rd thinks this is cool, but he thinks that he has the inside track. See, he thinks that this council is going to recognize him as ultimately as the true pope. So he comes riding into town, literally, on horseback, golden canopy over him, people shouting, "Hosanna, Hosanna." He comes in all his regalia, and he stands up, again, thinking that he's going to be kept as pope. He stands up and says, "I will gladly resign the papacy for the good of the church if these other two men resign it as well." Now he's thinking, oh, everybody will think this is great, and everybody will resign, and then they'll say, "We want you to be now the pope," right? Well, everybody thought that was great. This was progress, right? Instead of sending armies to beat each other up, now you have a guy who's finally said, "I'm going to resign." And they rang the church bells, and there's a story that one guy fell down and kissed his feet, and this was great. Well, about a day or two later, old John finds out that he is not going to be pope. And he's in big trouble, because he already made this big showing, right? So he dresses himself up like a stable boy, and he scoots out the side door. He takes off. Well, this completely disrupts the council. He thinks, now they can't do anything, I'm not there. Well, the council says, no, you know what, this doesn't mess anything up, because we're getting rid of all three of you guys, okay? So they end up capturing him. They bring him back, and they try him, and they find him guilty, and they throw him in prison. Now, this assures that he can't go back and become pope, right? Because if he's locked up in prison. It's said that he recanted the papacy, although the general thought is that either the document saying that was created, or that they basically put a gun to his head and said, "If you don't, you're toast, dude."
What was the crime that they convicted him.
They found that he was again, as that statement said by the council, that anyone that would go against the teaching or teachings of this council will get fit punishment. Mm-hmm. So because he betrayed what the council wanted, mm-hmm. So they throw him in prison. So they've gotten rid of one of the three guys claiming to be pope at this point. The Roman pope at this time, his guy's name is Gregory. He says, "You know what? Okay, I resign." The Roman Pope just says, "Forget it. I'm out of here. I'm done with this." He was a smart guy. That was the wise political move. The French Pope says, "No, I'm not resigning at all. And this council doesn't have any authority over me. I am the Pope. I have all the authority. And you guys can go jump off a cliff." Well, they try to... He meanwhile flees to Spain. because he saw what happened to John the 23rd. And so he flees to Spain, and they basically excommunicate him, this council does. He goes to his death still claiming to be the true pope. He will not accept any of this. And remember, he's in a line of guys that was originally elected pope by that council of bishops that had elected two guys. So coming out of this, the council itself, one guy they excommunicate in absentia because he's off in Spain hiding out. The second pope they throw in jail, and because he went against the decree of the council. And the third guy, like I say, he was smart. He just said, okay, I resign. I'm not pope anymore. Well, now you don't have any pope. This council now elects a pope, Martin V. And he becomes now the only pope. And from this point forward, you won't have this kind of situation again. Okay? Because this council was so powerful that even though for the next, gosh, I bet 100 years or more, the popes try to take authority back from the church council, the church councils ultimately will not allow any single man to have that kind of power because they don't want this situation happening in the church again. This was a really difficult time for the Christian church. This was before the Reformation. It wasn't like all the Protestants were sitting on the sideline and the Baptists were going, oh, look at those crazy Catholics. Everybody was Catholic at this time. This was something that affected the entire church. And again, the people that got hurt by this were the folks who were the guys showing up for Mass on Sunday, the folks who were trying to live their life as good, honest Christian people. And it was this kind of overlay of politics and personal ambition and church intrigue that created this situation. It also does create a difficult situation for a church historian to try to go back and say who was what. For Protestants, they're okay with that because Protestants don't have to show a direct line between the current pope and St. Peter. Catholic historians have a more difficult time. Normally, and in most cases nowadays, if you look at a list of the popes, from Peter to Benedict, you'll see that they follow the line of popes that remained in Rome. They take Urban and they go through to Martin. They do not take the popes that went to France. They do not include John the 23rd. Most modern Catholic Church historians will take the line of popes that remained in Rome. That's not always the case. Prior to the 19th century, you can find lists of popes where they picked and choose. But nowadays, if you look, and certainly, I mean, you know, if you go to any major Catholic encyclopedia and they give you a list of the popes, it will be down that line. That's just what they've determined to be the most accurate. I'm not a Catholic Church historian. I would be worried that the final guy in the Roman line did resign. And I know he did it because he felt it was important, but that does sort of, I think there's a little glitch there, and I'm not sure. I haven't read I was reading some Catholic historians this week for this, but I haven't read any that discuss that issue on it. But that's normally, if you look in the list of popes, it'll take you down from Urban. They don't recognize Clement. They go Urban down through his folks who came after him down to Martin. So the papacy is now set. That's no longer a problem. But what happens is this has really weakened the papacy. Now, the papacy is going to be very strong for a period of time. I don't mean that it folded and it went, but it's a little just chink in the armor. Okay. Meanwhile, in the big wide world out there, outside of the Christian church, a lot of stuff is changing. Think about it. This was happening 1370 up through 1415 was Constance. The world's starting to change. We're coming out of the medieval period, coming into the Renaissance. An interesting shift has taken place in Europe. I had a prof as an undergraduate in college who said, you know, you can tell the history of any city and how that city has changed in Europe based on the size of the buildings. And he said, a long time ago, in the medieval period, the most important building in any city was the church. and that was the largest building. At the end of the medieval period, into the Renaissance and forward, the church started to be less important, and what became important were the ruling people, the king or the person ruling that area. So the government building or the castle became the largest building in town. So while the church used to be the biggest building, now the biggest building is the government building. Now in the 20th century, modern period, well, everything past about the 19th century, the biggest buildings in town now are the office buildings, because now commerce is the most important thing. You no longer, while you have big, beautiful churches, they're not the biggest building in town. Most of the time, they're not quite as big as you know, the state capitol. And certainly the biggest buildings in town are going to be the skyscrapers. They're going to be the corporate entities. You know, you look at New York, and you look at the cathedral there, it's not nearly as big as the big skyscraper buildings, right? And that's sort of an image of what has happened in society in this time. The state and political stuff starts to really become hugely important, to the point that they would line up in this papal schism politically behind folks. That's important when it comes to the Reformation, because there was some political stuff going on there that helped, one, keep Martin Luther alive, but two, that supported the church and the Counter-Reformation, that supported the Protestant reformers, because you had a political battle between Germany and Rome, right? So this shift from church to state starts to happen, okay? Another thing came along was the printing press, right? That started to be a big deal. Another thing that you have happening, printing press, you've got the Renaissance. Now the Renaissance is interesting. This is a radical change at in a period of history. And it's easy for us to look back and we can put certain dates on things, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite that. I mean, it was a gradual change. And remember I talked about how when the Muslim invaders really conquered the East, that a lot of folks fled the East and they came to the West. And these were scholars. These were guys who brought all their books with them. Remember we said that Aristotle's writings started to be popular in the West, that Thomas Aquinas accessed those. What you have now is you have Greek manuscripts of the Bible coming over. Remember, in the West at this time, everything was in Latin, and they were still using the translation basically that Jerome had created called the Vulgate, which was the Latin translation of the Bible. Well, now all of a sudden, folks are looking at Greek, old Greek manuscripts in the New Testament, and they're comparing them to the Latin. And as with any translation from one language to the next, there's going to be some differences. And so you have this sort of neoclassical idea that's starting to come about in the West, where they're now looking at the great Greek writings. And it's scholars such as Erasmus and whatnot, who was a good Catholic guy, was starting to learn Greek and starting to learn Hebrew. And they weren't just working in Latin. And so you have this influx of all this stuff. The Renaissance, the shift in the Renaissance was, remember we talked about that there was the shift from Plato to Aristotle in Christian thought, from a otherworldliness of Plato to a real, actual man-centered sort of idea in Aristotle that Christian theology started to have. We can use reason to understand God and to prove God. Well, that also became part of the arts and the culture, that now you had more emphasis on man. And if you look at the artwork, you see the change. You know, in the great Greek sculptures and Roman sculptures, man was really created. You saw that it was beautiful. You could feel the fabric. You saw the muscles. There were these incredible things. Well, then it sort of shifted. You all of a sudden you had a real flat sort of look. You had all the images that are in the icons and whatnot. Well, now the art is shifting now again. You look at the incredible work of the Sistine Chapel. You know, there is, you know, that finger of God and that finger of Adam are real solid fingers. They're not just, you know, this is not an animated three-finger white glove kind of thing, right? I mean, this is, so you start seeing this shift. All of this is affecting what's going on. You also have a shift to a monetary system. I talked about this a little bit last week. You don't have barter anymore. You know, if I want something, I won't tell you, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you three chickens if you give me a goat. Now you start having a monetary system. I want that leather harness you made for the horse. Well, the guy doesn't want three pigs, a chicken, and a goat. What he wants is coins. So now you start having a monetary-based economy. This allows you to have something that we all know and love. This allows you to have taxes. See, taxes in antiquity were always like, okay, you give us a certain amount of your crop. But now taxes are, you give us a certain amount of money. We want currency. Well, that opens up, once you start taxing, you just keep on taxing. That's any government for the history of mankind. And so you start having taxes. Well, now the church starts thinking, wait a minute, we can now get money, right, to help do what we need to do as a church because people have money. So the church started to tax its followers to get money. So all this stuff is sort of happening. You know, we get up into the late 15th century, we start to have the exploration of the New World occurring. So now it's not just Europe anymore and that couple of hundred mile radius that you might have, but now we have this whole new place opened up. The globe is now no longer just you, your hometown, and this faraway country called England. It's now this faraway place called America. There's this new world out there. So all of this is changing. And it's just, it's all of these are little things, but they're all stacking up to really create what's going to happen in the Reformation. Now, the papacy, again, ever since the end of the schism, the papacy had good guys and it had bad guys. And everybody agreed it needed to be reformed. The people were still, you know, electing their nephew to be the bishop over this area, and they were still, you know, taking money, and there were good guys came along and they reformed it, and there were other guys that didn't. Part of the problem was some of these new popes started to really get into the whole Renaissance movement. Pope Julius took that name. Remember, popes don't have their, you know, it's like if I became pope, I wouldn't be Pope John. Right, I would take another name, right? And so Pope Julius took that name not because it was a great saint of the Bible. Pope Julius took that name because it was Julius Caesar. That's a big shift. Popes used to take the names of the apostles, you know, or saints, but now he took the name of in honor of a great Roman emperor. So there was this idea that the papacy needed to be back to its glory days. And they started building, and there's nothing wrong with this, they started building these huge churches. They started to build St. Peter's. They built the Sistine Chapel. Incredible artwork. The Sistine Chapel is one of the great pieces of art for the Western world. There's nothing particularly wrong with that. What got to be a problem was how they did this stuff. They didn't finish St. Peter's Basilica. So a pope comes along, Leo X, and he decides, we need to finish St. Peter's. And in order to do that, I got to have money. I can't just, you know, nobody's going to do this for free. I need money. So Leo X decided that he would raise money. And the way the church raised money was pretty much by getting people to give money to them for spiritual things. Now, up in Germany at the time, Germany was a very religious country, deeply religious country. But there was this deal, and this is very strange to us. It seems really weird to us, that a particular person, a bishop or an archbishop, could basically buy a bunch of parishes that he would then be in charge of if he sent enough money to whoever was his boss or ultimately down to Rome. Well, there was an archbishop up in Germany who really wanted to buy three or four of these parishes. He really wanted to expand his territory. So Leo X said, well, this is a great idea. I'll tell you what, I need money to finish St. Peter's. You want to buy these parishes to expand your area of authority. I'll tell you what, they agreed on the price of 10,000 ducats. And that way, you'll get your parishes, I'll get to finish St. Pete's. Right? Everybody's good with this. Well, the archbishop up in Germany said, okay, that's a pretty good idea. So he sets to fundraise to do this. Now, we all do that. I mean, the Christian church always does this, right? I'm sure that whatever church you've been at, if you decide we need a new building to house the junior high ministry or something, right? You figure out how much it's going to cost to stick a building on the back of the property, and you start a church building fund. And you ask everybody to give extra so we can build this building, right? Well, this was sort of a large-scale version of the church building fund. Except the church they wanted to finish was St. Peter's. And the way they were going to do this was get a bunch of guys up in Germany to give them money. Well, they got this guy named Tetzel, who was the top fundraiser for the church at that time. Tetzel was a priest, and this guy could bring in the money. I know you did the election last night. Everybody's quoting today, you know, the Republican nominee Whitman, she spent $80 million of money, right? Well, Tetzel was like one of these political fundraisers. This guy could crank up the funds. And it's interesting when you start reading the documents of this time about how this took place. This is an interesting book. I do not know if it's still in print. You guys know, from the beginning of this class, I've said that what's important for us is to read and to hear the original documents that were written at the time history was happening. You know, just reading what some guy wrote 100 years later might be okay, but if you can read the actual words of the people involved, it's even better, right? Well, this book, called The Reformation, is a narrative history using contemporary writings of the Reformation. I don't know if it's still in print. I don't think it is. It may be. I don't know. It's called The Reformation, and it's by Hans J. Hillerbrand, Hillerbrand. It was from 1964, so I don't know if, again, that was... The book is called The Reformation, A Narrative History Related by Contemporary Observers and Participants, edited by Hans J. Hillerbrand. Anyway, it's a really cool book. This is a letter that... Let me find the... this was from... Albert of Hohenzollern. I'm butchering the German there. My apologies to anybody that speaks German. And he was the guy. He was the archbishop who wanted to buy these parishes. And so this was his letter out. It was a summary instructions on how they were going to do this. Albert, by the grace of God and the apostolic chair, Archbishop of Magdeburg and Mainz, Primate and Chancellor of the Holy Roman Empire in Germany, Elector, Administrator of the Churches in Halberstadt, Margrave, and in Brandenburg, Duke and Stettin, etc., etc. That's his title. He was a big deal. He says, to all who read this letter, salvation in the Lord. We do herewith proclaim that our most holy Lord Leo X, by divine providence, a present pontiff, has given and bestowed to all Christian believers of either sex who lend their helpful hand for the reconstruction of the Cathedral Church of St. Peter, who was the Prince of the Apostles in Rome, complete indulgence as well as other graces and freedoms which the Christian believer may obtain according to the apostolic letter dealing with this matter. So Albert says, look it, to everybody, man, woman alike, doesn't matter, we have this great chance to participate in the building, to complete the building of St. Peter's in Rome. And I want you to contribute. Now, this, you're not contributing just for this building fund. You're going to get something out of this. Now, what he's offering is what's called indulgences. Now, I need to talk briefly about what this is so you can understand this, because frequently this gets yelled at and jumped around and with people not fully understanding the theology here. Especially for those of us who are all sort of Protestant side of the thing, most folks that grow up Baptist just don't understand what indulgences are. And what they do get is usually a skewed, very negative version as presented by whatever church history book they happen to read. I don't agree with the theology of indulgences. I'm not saying that my personal theology doesn't agree with that. But what I'm saying is we have to understand it. We're studying history. We have to understand it in the context of what was going on. For the longest time, the Christian church, hundreds of years. Remember, we're 1,500 years after Acts 2 here, okay? They had a strong belief that there is continuity between those of us who are alive as believers in Jesus and those who have died who are believers in Jesus. So that there is continuity. It's we are all one church. Now that's true in as much as the New Testament teaches that the universal church is the church that encompasses all believers in Jesus Christ, whether dead or alive, whether Old Testament or New Testament. Okay? So there's this idea of the continuity. Now remember we said that Augustine was struggling with the idea of what do you do about folks who are good Christians? We know they're Christians. But, you know, they got a little sin going on. They drink a little too much. They got a girlfriend. Something that's not right. And they die. Well, what happens to them? I mean, you know, they're really good Christians, but they die and they got this little sin going on. They can't be in God's presence. And so, and I remember I read that excerpt from Augustine where he said, what happens to them? There's got to be something that happens to get these guys cleaned up enough to be in front of God. Now, I would submit from my theological point of view that Augustine had a false premise, that I believe the New Testament teaches that the finished work of Christ covers all of our sins, so that when I die, even if I have sin, which the New Testament tells me I'm going to sin as a Christian, that's just how it happens, that it doesn't matter because God doesn't look at my sin. When God sees me, he sees the righteousness of Christ. This is called forensic justification. And it means that I don't stand in front of God in my own righteousness, I stand in front of God in the righteousness of Christ. So my answer to Augustine would have been, well, it doesn't matter because I have the righteousness of Christ, so if I sin, which I know I'm going to, I'm still okay to God. It's imputed to me. Okay, that would be my answer. I wasn't there. Augustine lived way before me. So Augustine was questioning that. Remember I said that then later on, Pope Gregory, great guy, Calvin-like Gregory, said, you know what, Augustine was right. There is a place where folks get cleaned up, and this place is called purgatory. Okay, so Gregory nailed down the whole purgatory thing. So now this idea had been in Christianity for a long period of time, that what happens is after people die, if they've got a little sin on them, they go to this place called purgatory where they get cleaned up to be in front of God. Okay? And that was the teaching. That's what, at the time of the Reformation, that's what people believed. Now, the other thing that people believed was that there was an intimate connection between those of us who are living Christians and those Christians who have died. And that I don't mean to insult the theology here, but the easiest way I can explain this is the concept of a checkbook, okay, or a bank account. I do certain things, certain religious activities, and God is pleased with that, and so God sort of adds favor to my account. Okay, the term is merit, but that's a loaded word in theology. So I do good things. Now, so in my account, I have so much good stuff. And then when I do bad things, when I sin, when I do bad stuff, that gets deducted from my account. Okay? This is the easiest way I can explain this. I don't mean to insult any theological position here. There was also the belief that I could transfer some of the good work that I did to people who had already died who couldn't do good work anymore because they were dead. So in other words, if my grandma died and went to purgatory, I could do something, I could do religious acts, and I would get this favor from God, and I could transfer that to my grandma's account, and I could get her out of purgatory into heaven quicker. Okay, that was the belief. Now, this transfer of favor was called indulgences. Okay, that's what indulgences were. It was the idea that the religious activity that I do that would bring favor from God could be applied not to me, but to those who I loved who were dead and couldn't do this work themselves and be applied. And that was consistent with the teaching of the church as starting from Augustine and working up through. So it was consistent theologically. Well, the technical term is merit, but it would be a favor that that I would get by doing religious activities that could be transferred to my loved ones or anybody. They didn't have to be a loved one. It could be my best buddy or somebody I thought was really nice and who needed to get bumped out of purgatory. So this was what was going on. So what the Archbishop in Germany said is, this is a great day, folks. We can help support the building of St. Peter's by giving our money, and you get something out of it. You get indulgences that you can apply to those loved ones or those friends that you want to get out of purgatory. Okay, now comes along John Tetzel. I don't know anybody, John Tetzel, who is the fundraiser par excellence. Now, I don't know anybody that thought Tetzel was an honorable guy. Okay? I have never met, and again, you know, my family's Catholic. I have a lot of friends that are Catholic. I don't know anybody. I had profs in college as an undergraduate. They were Catholic. I don't know anybody that thought Tetzel was a good guy. Okay? Everybody thinks Tetzel was a really immoral guy. But he said, I can exploit this whole indulgence thing to really get people to give money. Because Tetzel's job was to raise the money. Okay? Tetzel wasn't a theologian. Tetzel was a marketing guy. Okay? So, Albert says this is a great deal. We can get all this stuff. You guys can do wonderful things. We can build that church down in Rome, and you can get your loved ones out of purgatory. Give money, and you get indulgence. Tetzel comes along, and he starts just going to town on this. This is a sermon that Tetzel preached in Germany. He says, what are you thinking about? Why do you hesitate to convert yourself? Why don't you have fears about your sins? Why don't you confess now to the priests of our most holy Pope? Don't you have the example of Lawrence, who, compelled by the love of God, gave his away inheritance and suffered his body to be burned? Why don't you take the example of Bartholomew, of Stephen, and other saints who gladly suffered gruesome deaths for the salvation of their souls? So you can see, he's right off the bat. Tetzel is playing to the emotions here, okay? He said, today it's well, but ill tomorrow. Today alive, tomorrow dead. You know, it's funny. I went to Catholic high school, and the priests used to, during a student mass every week when we would have it, the priests would get up there, and they would let you know that the confessionals were open in the back. Now, this was an all-boy high school, okay? So you got a bunch of knucklehead teenage boys. The priest would frequently let you know about some guy they knew who had been a rapscallion of a young man who was just their age and who had died tragically and never got a chance to go to confession before he died. Well, it was amazing. Whenever this priest would stand up and do that, the line at the confessional in the back of the church during student mass would just double, right? I could, when I was reading through Tetzel's stuff, I couldn't help but think of this one priest who would preach that way. I suppose a little fear helps sometimes in motivating young men to be righteous. But so Tetzel is doing this. He is just going on and on and on about this. And he says, have mercy upon me, because we are all in severe punishment and pain. Open your ears, as the Father says to the Son, and the Mother and the Daughter. You let us lie in flames. He's talking now about their family. You let us lie here in flames so that we only slowly come to the promised glory. Why then are you so cruel and so harsh that you don't want to save us, though it only takes a little? So he's now telling him, your mom and your dad are in purgatory, and they're crying out to you, save us, Son. And what are you doing? You're not saving them. He is really playing to the emotions here. I'm not making this up. This is his actual sermon. He was not a great guy. So he goes on to say that they should give. Now, it's interesting because during this time, I'm not the only guy that was offended by Tetzel. Not just modern people are offended by it. The people at his time were offended by Tetzel. This was a report, sort of like a newspaper report almost at the time, talking about Tetzel. Remember, the Reformation hadn't happened. Right. These people that are criticizing Tetzel are all folks who are members of the church. Germany was a religious, godly place at the time. This account says that at that time, a Dominican monk named John Tetzel, Dominican being the Order of St. Dominic, not the Dominican Republic where we get baseball players. Okay, was the great mouthpiece, commissioner, and preacher of indulgences in Germany. His preaching raised enormous amounts of money, which were sent to Rome. This was particular in the case. And he goes on. He said that his indulgences were so good. I love this line. This is just great. Thus he said that even if someone had slept with Christ's dear mother, the Pope had the power in heaven and on earth to forgive him as long as they gave money in the indulgence coffer. That's what Tetzel was preaching. Tetzel's little line, by the way, that was his famous line, that was his marketing slogan, was, "When the coin in the coffers ring, another soul from purgatory springs." Okay, so Tetzel is just scorching the earth with this stuff. Tetzel was an immoral, terrible guy. Okay, he was worse. He was worse than the guys that go out there and tell you that there's no direct link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. Okay, Tetzel was just a bad dude when it came to this stuff. This infuriated this Augustinian monk who lived in Germany by the name of Martin Luther. Martin Luther absolutely was so frustrated with this that he couldn't hold his tongue anymore. Because what Martin Luther saw was this was a gross misuse of religious authority and power. And it was hurting people who were honestly trying to get their mom or their dad or their grandma, and so they were funding all this money. Now, the rest of Germany didn't like this because they started to pick up on the fact that all this money that Tetzel was raising was going back to Rome. Germany didn't want their money going to Rome, right? German nationalism said, no, we want our money here. We don't want to be shipped off to Rome. So now you got nationalism going against the money going to Rome. You got Luther saying, this Tetzel guy's out of bounds. Now, what Martin Luther does is Martin Luther says, okay, we need to have a discussion about this. We need to bring this out in the open, and we need to talk about this. Remember, Luther was a scholar. He was a monk, but he was a scholar. He figured he had all these points of disagreement. He had 95 of them, to be exact. And he wrote all these down. Now, back in this period of time, they didn't have Twitter. Okay, Martin Luther didn't have a blog. There wasn't email. The way you got people to talk about things was you would post what you wanted to discuss. Let's have a meeting. We all need to get together and talk about this. You would post it in a public place, on a big bulletin board, in the center of town. In Luther's case, he said, I'm going to post my 95 points of disagreement with Tetzel and all this stuff that's going on the church door, right, in the town there in Wittenberg. And I'm going to post it here, and everybody's going to read this, and then we can all get together and discuss this, because this kind of thing is just way out of bounds. So Martin Luther writes out his 95 points of disagreement, and he goes down and he tacks it on the church door in Wittenberg. He does this, by the way, on Halloween, 1517, October 31st, 1517. That is generally the date given for the beginning of the Reformation, October 31st, 1517. That's why Protestants, for Halloween, if they celebrate it, can dress up like Tetzel or Martin Luther or anybody they want and do this. So Luther does this. Well, now, remember I said that the printing press had been invented. People were able to make copies of this list. Gutenberg was the first one to use the type to do the Bible, yes. Luther also sent a copy of this off, too, to other folks. He honestly wanted everybody to sit down and discuss this issue. Luther did not, as some folks think, either for or against him, decide that this was when he was going to break with the Catholic Church. Luther was Catholic. Luther was a monk. He didn't want to break. He wanted to continue being a monk. What he didn't like was what Tetzel was doing. What he didn't like was how it was hurting the people who were giving their little bit of money under this, what he felt was a sham, simply to build this church down in Rome. Okay? Now, Luther's an interesting guy. I like Luther. I think he was a religious genius. Luther said about himself... Yeah, let me find it here. Luther said about himself, he said, I'm the son of a peasant. My great-grandfather, grandfather, and father were peasants. I should have become a superintendent, a bailiff, or the like in the village, a servant with authority over a few. But my father moved to another town and became a mining operator, and that's where I come from. So Luther said, look, I'm just a regular guy like everybody else. He says that I became, these are the terms used in the time, baccalaureus and magister. In other words, that I became a monk and a theologian and a priest, but afterwards took off my cap, giving it to others, that I became a monk, which brought shame upon me as it bitterly annoyed my father. Martin Luther's dad didn't want to become a monk, okay? He didn't like that at all. And that the Pope and I came to blows, and that I married an apostate nun Who would have read this in the stars? Who would have prophesied that? Luther, in looking back, said, you know what? All my family were peasants. I ticked off my dad when I became a monk. And the fact that I would become the center of this thing, fighting with the Pope, marrying an ex-nun, who would have thought? But that's what happened. By Martin Luther posting his 95 thesis on the Wittenberg church door, it opened up the Reformation. It's important as now, and we're gonna follow this next week. We're gonna look at Luther. We're gonna look at the post-Reformation, all the folks that fought. And we're gonna talk about the Catholic Church's response at the Council of Trent. But what Luther started on Halloween in 1517 was the biggest thing to happen to the Christian Church. It would end up dividing the church into two groups, Protestants and Catholics. That divide has never been sealed up. To this day, if you're a Christian, you're a Protestant, you're a Catholic. Well, let's not forget our Orthodox friends, right? You could be Greek or Russian Orthodox, you can be Coptic. But that church split happened right back in the 12th century, and that one was never mended, but this was a bigger one. This divided the entire Western church.
Okay. The East and West Church.
That, remember, that happened back in the 12th century. They split Roman Constantinople. That one never got healed up. That was big. This one, I think, was bigger. I think because I'm a Western Christian that it's bigger to me. I suppose if I was a Byzantine Christian, I'd think that that was the bigger deal and that this one didn't matter. But this was a big deal. Now,
John, real quick.
Yeah.
How does the Eastern Orthodox Church view that that split between the Catholic Church in the West becoming Protestant and Catholic? How did they view that?
At the time, or prior to that, a century or so prior to that, Constantinople really was in desperate straits when they were finally going to fall to the Turkish Empire. And they requested that the West come to their aid. And they said, we'll reunite with Rome if you come to our aid. Well, at the time, the papacy was having its own trouble. I mean, you had three guys. So Constantinople never got its help, and it fell to the Turkish Empire. Today, if you talk to most folks who are good Greek Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox Christians, they will tell you that the Protestants are really a bunch of guys who broke off from the true church. That Rome, even with its disconnect with the Eastern Church, is still probably should be the main church in the West, and that quite frankly, the Orthodox Church itself is really the only church that goes all the way back to the apostles. Mm-hmm. That you know, they're really the true church, but Rome is pretty darn close. But the Protestants, they're just a bunch of rabble rousers. You know, I have been teaching the college group. And we're at the point where we're talking about eschatology. We're talking about the end time stuff. And I was explaining to him, you know, and I attend a very conservative a Christian church, okay? It's a free church, member of the free church denomination. Very conservative. We would, if somebody said, how do you describe you guys? Our church would say, we're a Bible-based Christian church. But our view that I'm teaching the college group is the view of our particular church and our denomination on the end times, what we feel is going to happen, what the biblical view of the end times is, which would be consistent with what ICC teaches here, what Hadavar teaches. It's consistent with that. But I tried to tell the kids in the college group, I said, while this is what I'm going to teach you, and this is what our church believes and what our denomination believes, you have to understand that our particular belief, not just in this area, but our Christian belief in general, is a small slice of the big Christian pie. The majority of people in this world who claim to be Christians do not believe what myself and what I'm teaching these college kids, okay? We are a very small slice. The majority of Christians in the world are either going to be Catholic or Orthodox. Protestants are a small slice of that. Protestants are getting bigger, but they're still not as big. If you're doing one of those USA Today charts with color and everything, the Protestant slice of that pie wouldn't be very big. And the slice of the Protestant pie that most evangelical Christians, especially in Southern California, are, is an extremely thin slice of that pie. Now, I don't mean to say that numbers matter in Christianity. Okay, it's not that those people who the creed that has the most people that believe in it is the correct one and the one that has the least it. I don't mean to say that, but we all have to understand how we fit in that big picture. When it comes to Protestantism, evangelical Christians are a smaller slice. When it comes to the overall picture of Christianity, Protestantism is a smaller slice of that pie. Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodox, much bigger. And then on the global scale, you know, and that's just how it is, you know. And just because you happen to have the larger numbers doesn't mean you're correct either. It doesn't, you know. You have to understand that it's Christianity isn't a matter of numbers. Christianity, in my opinion, not to reflect the opinion of ICC or Hadavar, my opinion, Christianity has nothing to do with religion. Christianity is an intimate, personal relationship with the supreme God of the universe. Christianity is my relationship with God the Father and with Jesus. That's what Christianity is. It's not, I would even go so far as to say it's not my theology. It is an intimate relationship between me and God. I believe that God the Father has, through God the Son, through Jesus Christ, and the finished work of Christ on the cross has made it so that when I trust in Him, I have eternal life with God the Father. And that is the most intimate, it is the relationship, parallel in the world would be the relationship I have with my children or the marriage union that I have with my wife. That's what Christianity is. Now, I practice Christianity in a certain way. I mean, I go to a certain church and I do certain Christian actions. But that's not what Christianity is. Christianity is the relationship between God and an individual. Okay, so my theology certainly has a lot to do with it. How I understand God, how I relate to Him. My theology colors how I act as a Christian. But Christianity is about that relationship. So when I look at the big picture and I go, wow, I'm a tiny little slice of that big round circle, that doesn't worry me because my relationship is with God. And my trust is for eternal life is in the finished work of Christ. That's what's important. I'm not worried that I'm not in the big numbers. I used to be in the big numbers, right? Yeah, I grew up in the big numbers. But that's not the important thing. What's important as a believer is your relationship with God, and that you should be committed to understanding the truth about God. That's the deal. Everything else is secondary. If you honestly have the truth about God, then everything else doesn't matter because you'll be in the correct place theologically. You'll be in the correct place of how you live. The truth is the ultimate thing you tie to, okay? Not the fact that I was a Presbyterian and my dad was a Presbyterian and his dad. That doesn't matter. It's that you have the relationship with God, the intimate relationship with God, and that you seek to find the truth as related to God. That's what matters in all of this. Part of this study of history is to help us see how everybody else has worked through all this stuff over 2,000 years. That's what we're looking at here. We can't discount it. We can't discount, even though Christianity is about my intimate relationship with God, I can't discount the fact that I've got brothers and sisters that I worship with, that God uses in my life to work to make me better, that uses me in their life to work to make them better. You know, I can't discount the body at all. But ultimately, at the very bottom line, it's that relationship I have with God, or His relationship with me. So, but yeah, numbers-wise, we're a small piece of the pie. Roman Catholicism is the largest single Christian denomination. So
it's basically between Roman Catholicism and the Eastern
Orthodox. Eastern Church, and then the Protestant wing. And so you kind of have those three groups. Okay. And the Protestant wing is, I believe, the smallest of the three. And our little slice of it, evangelical Christianity, is by far the tiniest slice of that Protestant slice. Or like I like to call us, the faithful remnant. Nah, that's just the faithful remnant. But, you know, that's just me being sarcastic. So, okay, next week we're going to look at more detail of the Reformation. We're going to look at how the Reformation changed, how folks who came after Luther. We're going to look at Council of Trent, which was the Catholic counter-Reformation movement. And a lot of this stuff now is going to start to impact how nowadays we understand ourselves as Catholics or Presbyterians or Baptists or Moravian Brethren. Because it all kind of came shook out of all this stuff. Okay.